The passage we've just heard is famous. It's the rendering in the King James Version, "Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's," which has become a well-known phrase in our language. We see Jesus' enemies try to trap him. If he agreed that taxes could be paid under Jewish law, he'd have been seen as a collaborator with a hated occupying power. After all, the taxes paid for the occupation. The crowd that followed him in the hope that he, as a Messiah, would throw off the Roman yoke, would have deserted him overnight. Yet, if he had said, "No, taxes are unfair, they pay for our oppression, and God is a God of justice," then the Romans would have pounced on him very quickly as a seditious rabble-rouser. Which is why the entrappers asked the question. They asked, sat back and smiled, thinking, "What are you going to do with that then, mate?" Jesus is being asked about the relationship between religion and state. And of course, he dodged the question. The answer would have amused those who were on his side, puzzled his questioners, but I suspect would have won a grudging admiration for his ability to sidestep the trap. However, the relationship between church and state is one that has troubled the church for all of its existence, and it's an interesting thing to ponder. The earliest church had to work out if it was simply a Jewish movement and therefore legal, or something else. As more and more Gentiles became Christians without first becoming Jewish, the church and the synagogue separated. This was significant because in the Roman Empire, everyone had to worship the Roman gods. That worship may have only consisted of offering some incense to a statue of a god, saying a prayer for the emperor. On some of the crazier emperors, you might have to pray to them. But it wasn't much, just a bit of incense, a quick prayer, and you were fine. In a society which consisted of many races, faiths, and cultures, the imperial religion held the empire together. Gods of different nations were adopted into the Roman system, and everyone was happy. Everyone, that is, except the Jews. The Jews stubbornly refused to worship anyone other than God. They were rather troublesome. They were given to revolt. And the Romans, being pragmatic, made an accommodation to recognize them as a legal religion. They were the only legal religion that wasn't Roman paganism. If the church was simply a group of Jews that followed the teachings of Rabbi Jesus, then they'd be protected under Roman law. If, however, they weren't Jewish, and all those male Gentiles really didn't want to go through the Jewish conversion ceremony, then they weren't protected. So Romans saw Christians as antisocial and a threat to the cohesion of the empire. In truth, the Romans were right. We were, and still should be, subversive. And so, from time to time, the church was persecuted. The persecution was never everywhere, but in various places it was hard, and people were put to death if they didn't offer worship to pagan deities. The New Testament reflects the difficult relationship with the state. In Romans 13, before the persecution really got going, Paul asserts that the emperor is from God and should be obeyed. In Revelation 13, written during a time of persecution, the empire is seen as satanic. Since then, the church has oscillated between Paul and Revelation's view of the state. In the 4th century, however, everything changed because the Emperor Constantine became emperor after a battle he won, attributing his victory to the blessing of Jesus, as if Jesus blesses battles. This led to the establishment of Christianity as the state religion of the Roman Empire, and eventually paganism was outlawed. Many temples became churches, and the church went from being persecuted to very quickly becoming persecutors. If anyone was convicted of believing the wrong things, then the state was expected to execute them. Until the Reformation, no dissenting Christian voices were allowed. The Reformation in these islands, however, was never about religious freedom. Down south, it was about the king wanting a divorce and then some ideas coming in from Geneva. Up here, it was more about ideas from Geneva and John Knox. But freedom wasn't granted. The Catholic Mass was outlawed north and south. Catholic priests were persecuted. Protestants soon became as intolerant as the medieval Catholic Church had been. It wasn't until much later that the persecution stopped. The anti-Catholic laws weren't repealed until 1829, 300-400 years after they'd been introduced. And earlier attempts at making life easier for Catholics were met with riots in Scotland and in London. Over the 19th century, the influence of the church waned, and into the 20th century, we're seen as being largely irrelevant. That, in a sense, has led to some good things. Greater freedom in society came along in the 1960s. That was only possible because Parliament no longer saw itself as having to uphold a particular Christian view of the world. Now, in the West, the church is largely irrelevant to the state. Coronations are still expected to be religious, and as we saw from the coinage, we're not only a kingdom, but one that officially believes the monarch is given to us by the grace of God. But in all meaningful ways, we're a secular state, with all the freedoms and problems that causes. So, what should we expect to be the relationship between the church and the state? I expect we don't want a situation where the state tells us what to do, nor a situation where we tell the state what to do. We may long for more influence, but we have to be careful not to fall into traps. Just as Jesus was tempted into a trap, so the church can be tempted into modern traps when we think about our relationship with the state. The first is to see Christianity as something which is private. In our contemporary society, religion is seen as private. It's for the home or the church, for those who like that type of thing. It's about private spirituality. If you want to say a prayer, light a candle, go on a fast, give money to a peculiar cause, that's fine. Just don't let your faith interfere with everybody else. Faith is for those who need to unburden themselves privately, to have their own spiritual moments. Now, there's much good about that. Humans are spiritual, and the church has much to offer as people make sense of the spiritual aspects of their lives. We need somewhere to unburden ourselves, to heal from the wounds of life, to find rituals which are helpful. The problem is, if that is all faith is, then we have nothing to say to wider society. No critique of injustice, no critique of anything which oppresses. A private faith, which is not the same as a personal faith, but a private faith has nothing to say about political responsibility or social behaviour. It becomes toothless. Then there is the trap of seeing the church as a members-only club or a close-knit community. The late 19th century sociologist Emile Durkheim described society. In the pre-industrial societies, there was glue which held a community together. Unless you went hunting together, you went hungry. In agricultural society, the ties that bound you and the land together were very clear. Unless the farmer farmed and unless you helped, you didn't eat. In our contemporary society, we're largely divorced from growing our own food. If you want sausages for dinner, you tend to go to Tesco's. You don't go and find a pig. Someone else does the hard work for us. We buy our meat nicely wrapped in plastic and don't want to or need to think about the fate of the cow or the lamb or the piggy that is now wrapped in plastic in Mr. Tesco's. We live in streets and often don't know our neighbours. It's a bit different in Scotland, you're friendlier. But in Manchester, we lived on a street of 12 houses and only knew two others that lived in those houses. That's because it's an area of change with people moving in and on quite regularly. We live in an age when we can talk to people on the other side of the world for no cost using the internet, but may not know the family two doors down on our street. Now, Durkheim foretold this and said we'd be alienated from each other. In a society like that, the church can easily become the place where community is built, where we become a club against the cruel realities of the world, a place where we're known and loved, a place where we leave loneliness behind. After all, Marx, rather movingly, I think, said, "Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It's the opium of the people." Now, Marx wasn't a fan of religion. It might soothe, but he thought in that soothing stopped people changing the world. Yet the world is painful, and faith can mitigate the pain. Now, of course, we need community. We need friendship. We need to counterbalance the individualism and loneliness of our world. The church is great at that, but we fall into a trap if that's all we do. If all we're concerned about is community that bandages the wounds of our cruel world, then we offer the opium that Marx wrote of and lose our opportunity to proclaim the coming kingdom when our world will be turned upside down. We are more than a counterbalance to society. Instead, we're foretellers of a new society, a new world order, a new realm where everything will be different. And the final trap is the one of being an institution. In a world of rapid change, it's comforting to have the institutional church. The moderator of the Church of Scotland is trotted out for state occasions up here, the Archbishop of Canterbury at royal weddings, the Bishop of London at the Cenotaph on Remembrance Sunday, as in the picture, bishops in the House of Lords, all give a sort of connection with a bygone age. And as long as the institutions are trusted, can give comfort. But the problem with institutions is they betray our trust. The church is reeling from the abuse it has perpetrated and hidden. Rank hypocrisy has been exposed. If we leave it all to the institution, we'll always be let down. So these traps are powerful, but also reflect necessary aspects of the church. We may not like institutions, but institutions pay for ministers. The provision of community is very healing in our world. And we need to nurture a personal faith, if not a private one. Yet because these things are necessary and easy, we can easily become attracted to them and trapped by them. If we fall into these traps, we're seen as socially useful, but lose the ability to say that which society doesn't want to hear. A private religion has no business telling banks to pay their taxes. A mere social club has no business telling politicians to mend their ways. An institution mired in sin has no ability to be a witness to our world. Jesus calls us to render to God that which is God's. All too often we render to Caesar, the world, but leave God out of the equation. We've been busy showing the world how relevant we are, but forget the world's going to change. The coming kingdom is what we're called to proclaim. Not to forget about the world, but to serve it in the light of the cross and resurrection of Jesus. We're here to be a revolutionary force in history, to remind the rulers of our world they will have to give account, to proclaim a world order where all matter, where all have enough, where all are valued. If we remain private, club-like, and institutional, we sanctify society as it is, whereas we have to force Christianity to refuse to identify it with the current order, but always to proclaim the coming kingdom. We need a relationship with the state where we continue to assert that we all have value because God values us. We need to work for and model a society where all are treated well without regard to race or class or gender or any other irrelevant distinction. We need to critique those who create a hostile atmosphere in our society for those who fled here to be safe. We need to model the society that Jesus spoke of, where the first should be last and the last should be first, where the weakest are central, where the lath of death and decay in our passing world needs to be replaced by the radical love of God, which has zest and a desire for life. Our personal but not private faith enables us to live as disciples who model the coming kingdom. Our church can be a haven from the world, but never should it lose sight of our mission to the world. And whilst we're part of an institution, we should never let that institution be going without critique. Will you pray with me? Vulnerable God, you challenge the powers that rule this world. Through the needy and the compassionate and those who are filled with longing, make us hunger and thirst to see right prevail and single-minded in seeing peace, that we may see your face and be satisfied in you, through Jesus Christ. Amen.